The movies are one of the bad habits that corrupted our century. An eruption of trash that has lamed the American mind and retarded Americans from becoming a cultured people. Now, quite seriously, why do you regard movies as such trash?
It wasn't I who made the money. But Uncle Sam and my brother, they made all the money. I wound up broke.
You'll see the corruption of a writer.
May have something to do with your habits in spending money.
The government makes we movie people who are not bosses working iron hands, cooks, janitors, clerks. We get paid a salary and we get paid a suddenly pay most of all. We haven't a corporation. We get to that. But then
do what?
You're not suggesting that we hold a tag day for Ben Hanks?
I wouldn't mind. It might help. My reason for disliking the movie is a little odd. I really don't dislike them. I have no interest in them any more than a plumber has any vital interest in his product. He has to know how to make his stuff, do it well, collect his money. He doesn't have to admire what he makes.
Well, now I think that's unseeming modesty. You say you have no interest in them. You have sufficient interest to call them trash. You say that they have lamed the American mind, retarded Americans from becoming a cultured people.
The rest of that quote was, the reason they have lamed the American mind, when I speak of the American mind in this book you're quoting from, I was talking of what used to be called the intelligentsia, the high-class thinkers. The people haven't been lamed by the movies, they've been helped by them. They helped by all mass entertainment, it diverts them. But in my day, a man would rather be caught dead than be seen reading a dying novel or a Western classic about Stormy's horse. And this superiority snobbery which made the intelligentsia was washed away by the movies. People started going to movies that were made out of dime novels, that were written from the same point of view, that had for their objective mass success. And I think the reason our literary side collapsed considerably was that the snobbery left us. Superior intellectual attitude left us.
Oh, Ben, but you're suggesting that all movies are trash, and that's not so. Take a look at movies like Marty, or On the Waterfront, or Hat Full of Rain, or Bridge on the River Kwai. Now, these are all Hollywood or Hollywood-oriented products.
I've written some that weren't trash myself. Maybe out of 70, I've written about 8 or 9 movies that I could tolerate if I were a member of the audience.
Like, for instance, which ones?
I wrote a movie called Wuthering Heights, The Scoundrel, Viva Villa.
You also wrote The Iron Petticoat.
Yes.
And the New York Times said
I wrote The Iron Petticoat, but I took my name off it.
I know you did. For reasons best known to Ben Hecht, New York Times said, he declined to have his name mentioned in the credits. A witness to the finished picture may readily figure out why. Why do you get involved with such trash?
Well, it wasn't trash when I started. You see, a movie begins, like most things, with an idea. And then it turns out that the inventor of the idea, who is usually the writer, is a stowaway. He has the privileges of a stowaway. He has no powers to assert himself. And there are about 10 or 15 villains, including his own incompetence usually, that corrupts what he originally thought of. In this particular case, in The Iron Petticoat, the corruption came through the recutting of the movie, and the movie was written for a lady, Miss Katharine Hepburn. It ended up as sort of a solo for the hero, Mr. Bob Hope. Miss Hepburn was removed from it about 50%. I got irritated, took my name off it, but it had nothing to do with the movie I wrote.
But the fact of the matter is that you've said time and again, Ben, that you've sold out. You sold out to make a buck. Isn't that true?
Well, what do we all do? You're making a buck. I'm making a buck. I don't sell out anything. I've written 24 books while writing movies, written 12 plays, written 300 short stories. I'm kept alive by working in a movie. You cannot have two homes, one on the East Coast, one on the West Coast.
Well, wait. Now, in one breath you say Hollywood puts together trash, and the next breath you say, give me $100,000 and I'll grind out whatever you tell me, and who cares what it does to the American mind. Isn't that about what you say?
No, well, I leave that guilt up to the movie maker. I just do what I'm told. I take assignments. I used to work on newspapers. I took assignments. I take assignments from movie people. There's very little a writer can do to improve a movie. The writer is usually paid not to assert himself, not to intrude, and then the reason that Hollywood has become a cropper.
Well, now wait.
Is that the writer has had nothing to do with the situation.
The writer has had nothing to
nothing
do
with it.
We talked about this this week with another top screenwriter, Paddy Chayefsky, who admires you very much, by the way. He's the fellow who wrote Marty and The Bachelor Party, and he said this. He said, it's all up to the individual writer. Chayefsky said, I've never written just for money in my life. I'd rather hand the money back than write something just because somebody else tells me to.
Sounds like little Goldilocks. I'm sure he changed his mind after he's been out of here a while. He had one success, and one success usually gives a fellow feverish ideas about who he is and what he can do and how important he is. After you've had four or five successes and about 50 failures, you change your mind.
Ben, your latest play, Winkelberg, is about the Bohemian poet Maxwell Bodenheim, who starved because he refused to compromise and sell out his talents. Now, is it possible that you're fascinated by Bodenheim simply because he kept his integrity while you haven't been particularly zealous in guarding your own?
Well, I think I was more zealous than Bodenheim because I kept my character intact. Bodenheim didn't guard his talents. He was, like all poets, remarkably incompetent socially. He couldn't move in any circle where liquor wasn't the passport. And he protected nothing. I don't know what his record is. I haven't read all his books. He wrote several good books of poetry. We all wrote several good books when we were young. Bodenheim interested me only as a springboard in a play.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know him for many years before his death.
But this smiling cynicism of yours, Ben, our society thinks very ill of people who sell their bodies for money. And yet we don't seem to think as ill of people who sell their minds and their other talents for money.
You'd be in grave trouble if you thought ill of those kind of people, because they represent about 99 9/10% of the Americans.
Why?
Every oil man, every radio commentator, everybody who works sells out. And usually they sell out more than their minds. They sell out their soul, their character, their point of view. And they sell out in order to conform with what their neighbor is thinking. Usually they throw in the sponge when they're about 22 or 23 and they quit. They become echoes, they echo each other, terrified of making any odd remark, even at a dinner table. The American has become, in my time, one of the most ironed out human beings I've ever seen. He's sort of an imitation Russian today. He can't think for himself, speak for himself, terrified of saying he doesn't like my fair lady, terrified of making any crack against anything that's successful or popular.
Mm. Ben, we hear so much about Hollywood as an American institution. To some people, it's kind of a Sodom and Gomorrah with swimming pools. What is it to Ben Hecht?
The place where I've earned a living for 30 years, done some fairly good work, off and on. So I don't know how bad my bad work is. I've not seen any of the movies I've done, except if I were told they were terribly good, I would go see them, because, to repeat, the writer has as much to do with the movie as an usher has to do with the general running of the theater. I remember talking about this once. The producers, you see, sunk this town. They sunk it after coming in the ascendancy about 25 years ago. There was a movie once called Stormy's Horse. This was a wonderful picture of the producer to me. Stormy's horse ran down a gully, and Stormy fell off his horse and was shot. The horse platted up the gully, came back, came into the saloon where Stormy's pals were standing at the bar, and he nudged them with his wet nose. And one of the pals says, "That's Stormy's horse, he's trying to tell us something." And this was my version of producers for 30 years. I was always feeling their wet nose, nudging me, trying to explain what I should write and tell me what to do.
Well, I think in reading Child of the Century, I read it on the plane coming out here again, or parts of it again.
Better than sleeping pills.
You, as a matter of fact, it kept me up. You seem to have more contempt, however. You have a kind of a pleasant feeling almost for the producers and certainly for the actors and actresses. You reserve your contempt for the owners of the motion picture studios.
Yes, they did something that cannot be done. You cannot make entertainment only from a monetary point of view. And the movies, from its very, very beginning, turned into a business, the sausage factory, and the writer, and even the director, who's also a pretty smart fellow, they were both shoved out of the picture, and the man with the money, the man with the biggest chair and the biggest desk and the biggest office, was a man who knew what to do. And most movies, about 90% of them, were made in conference by producers and studio owners, and they were representatives of the people who actually had the money control of the studios. And their whole objective, so far as I was concerned, was to make a movie that would make money. It wasn't a wrong objective, because it isn't wrong with oil people or steel people, nothing wrong with movie people try to make money, but entertainment can't be made that way. You end up just as Hollywood has ended up. And no more big studios, the producers are trying to get other forms of employment, and the movies are dying because they killed off the people who could make them, the writer and the director. They took away their identity. I never knew when I was writing a movie whether my hero would end up being called Joe or Mabel, or whether the locale would be Pekin or Akron.
Ben, do you regard Hollywood as rather a sad town now?
Well, it's sad compared to the gay, charming, wondrous town it once was. When you got off the train in the old days, I told you, this pockets filled with gold before you got to the hotel. Everybody was young, everybody had the world by its tail, everybody was going to be a wizard and a success, and oddly enough, everybody turned out to be that. We had nothing but geniuses in this town. If you weren't a genius, you hardly could eat out. Geniuses dominated the whole city from stem to stern. This is gone. We have nothing but people running out of a burning building today in Hollywood.
Is it possible that you're just looking back on your youth through rose-colored glasses, Ben? You wrote in the book, you said, many habits were formed by those days. And you were talking about your early days, 20, 30, 35. You said, many habits were formed by those days, and points of view which I have never outgrown or improved upon came to roost in my head. That's a continuing theme in everything you write. Now, is it possible? Well, do you think it's becoming for a man of 62 to have the same attitude towards life as a man of, let's say, 20 or 25 had?
It's not only becoming, I regard it as heroic. If you can keep your young ideas, it's almost as good as keeping your young body.
When you say, you talk about almost as good as keeping your young body, do you mind very much growing old, Ben?
It's horrid. You're sorry to say everybody grows old, and you'll answer that question yourself someday. It's a horrid experience.
We've interviewed other older people, and, older than you, Eleanor Roosevelt, Frank Lloyd Wright. They don't seem to mind the passage of the years, because all of their adult lives they have been engaged in meaningful work, work which they still do. It could it be that you engaged in mostly carefree adolescent work, like writing for Hollywood still, and therefore old age comes as something of a menace to you?
No, I haven't engaged in meaningless work. I've written about 8 books the last 8 years, which I personally like very much. And people who say they don't mind growing old are just telling sad little lies to you. Everybody minds growing old. And when I look back, I don't always see my youth is better. My bank book was better. Everything about me was better, and work was easier. You ask any prize fighter whether your mind is growing old. Everybody loses a punch, sort of. And the people who think they're doing important work, Mrs. Roosevelt has been repeating herself like some parrot with 3 cliches for the last 15 years. I don't regard anything she's been doing as important. I don't know who else you mentioned, but
Frank Lloyd Wright.
Frank Lloyd Wright.
No parody.
No, Frank Lloyd Wright stopped working about 20 years ago. I don't think he's drawn a picture in 20 years. He's been exercising charm and civilization.
If I may switch the subject abruptly, Ben, do you get any consolation at all from religion?
No, I regard religion as a part of rather odd mythomania that has persisted in the world. I think anybody who gets consolation from religion is much the same as any scientist who might get consolation from the delusion that the world was flat. Religion has changed. God has different coloration, different meaning today.
You're a Jew.
Yes.
Means nothing to you?
No more than a Kentuckian.
Last year, Ben, a group of Jewish scholars attended a meeting of the Synagogue Council of America. They charged that the observance of Judaism in America was declining, that religious observances were disappearing among American Jews. Now, obviously, as a Jew, this gives you no particular cause for concern.
I'm very pleased to hear it. I think observance of religious, formalized religion, I think its disappearance is a sign of the increased intelligence of the human race. I think people are more able to feel God and think of Him if they get out of their churches and think in terms of their own political feelings rather than in terms of myths that have sort of grown a little stale.
What do you mean by their own political
poetical
feelings?
When you look out at the sky, at the sun, at the night, at the morning, when you think of the various monstrous things that are in the universes and the enormity of everything, you get quite impressed, much more impressed when you read some very bad hymn with a bad tune, or some chuck out of Goethe's Revelation. You can't get nearly as impressed by the writings of second-rate people, usually unsuccessful poets, as you can by looking at the subject matter which they wrote.
So much for religion. Want to talk a little politics?
I wouldn't mind. I don't know much about politics.
Well, you have opinions.
Yeah, opinions I have.
Recently you've been complaining that newspaper men, you were a newspaper man for a good many years, you've been complaining that they no longer criticize sufficiently our political figures. You said 30 years ago we quoted them accurately to get them into trouble. We howled with laughter at them, but that's not done enough anymore. So in a moment, I'd like to give you your chance. You can take any leading political figure in the United States and evaluate him, pro or con, as you see fit to your heart's desire.
Interesting.
And we'll get Ben Heck's reaction to that in just 60 seconds.
From the nation's leading independent research laboratory comes this important announcement. The first filter cigarette in the world that meets the standards of the United States Testing Company. Parliament, with a new high filtration filter.
This is the cigarette, Parliament. And these are the facts, proved. In Parliament, over 30,000 traps, the most effective filtering material in a cigarette today. No other popular cigarette delivers less tar and nicotine. Proved in Parliament, the exclusive recessed filter holds trapped tar and nicotine away from your lips. There's no leakage from filter to mouth. Proved in Parliament, the most complete filtering action in cigarette history. And the flavor story is simple. More expensive tobaccos bring you the friendly satisfaction that cigarettes were invented for.
The filtering findings you have just seen are certified true by the United States Testing Company. Parliament, now at popular price.
That's the Parliament story. Parliament recessed filter is best. Try Parliament yourself. All right, Ben, let's have at him. And we'll start at the top, President Eisenhower.
Well, if I were a young reporter and were asked to write about Mr. Eisenhower in Mencken's old smart set or the Mercury, I would have written that politicians should be not seen and not heard, and that Mr. Eisenhower is perhaps as inaudible and invisible an executive as this country's ever had. He is trying to save the world by boring it to a point of inanity. He's got a good running mate, Mr. Nixon, who's possibly the best, most well-dressed errand boy Washington has seen in a long time. I would be pleased with Mr. Eisenhower because I am displeased with politicians, and he is so vague, amorphous a figure that I think he's ideal for to represent us. I think politicians are public servants, and like a good domestic staff, they should function, keep the house running, and without throwing fits in the living room. I think Mr. Eisenhower neither throws fits nor speaks, so that he distracts me in any way.
Well, let's get on the other side of the fence. There are various people who are mentioned as potential presidential candidates for the Democratic Party. Start with Adlai Stevenson.
I liked Mr. Stevenson when he was himself. I thought he became pretty dull when he started being a non-Mr. Stevenson, tried to be a politician. I thought he was as dull as Eisenhower in the last run.
How about young Jack Kennedy?
I don't know. I read his book forgot his name.
Profiles in Courage?
Profiles in Courage. I thought it was a fair book. I thought it was dangerous to have a man of intelligence and intellect in the White House. I think you ought to have a man of good heart who has no ambition and sleeps a lot. Make the best kind of person.
Tell me about Harry Truman. He doesn't sleep a good deal. Early riser.
Well, I don't know much about Harry Truman. He once attacked me.
For what?
For some work I was doing about Palestine. And I remember telling one of you boys that he was an American and had as much a right to shoot his mouth out as I had, which he did to a considerable extent. He was possibly the most articulate, noisy president we had since Teddy Roosevelt, who was an idol of mine. This was before I was disliked by the pigeon.
Tell me this. Who do you really like?
I like all people. I like all people who do right. All people who live happily. All people who have good, kind hearts. As for whom I like out front, hard to say. They're mostly dead. My pets are in the ground.
What do you get passionate about? What excites you? What do you like?
Well, it's hard to get passionate about anything these days because you like to get arrested. Our censorship in this country is not exercised by police states, exercised by some mysterious thing that keeps your mouth with a clothespin on it. I don't know what it is.
Well, let's try to find out. We've got 2 minutes left.
2 minutes left? I don't know. I think it's just a general terror of what's going to happen. Everybody's so afraid of the disasters that have been advertised that they sort of fall to mumbling and muttering and all talking alike. There's a herd that's about to be slaughtered.
Well, and what would you suggest that we do in its stead?
Well, might go to see Winkelberg, my play, which celebrates the excitement of being an individual and defying all things of that matter. So, I have no solutions for anything. I just know how to keep going.
Ben, you're on television tonight. What do you think of television?
Well, television excites me because it seems to be the last stamping ground of poetry. It's the last place where I hear women's hair rhapsodically described, women's faces told in odic language. The commercials are, to me, the most thrilling and exuberant poetry that's left in the United States.
Well, you'll have a chance to hear one in just about a minute, Ben, but you've said that it's a baby-sitting industry cooing at the crowds. It threatens to turn us all into furniture.
It will when it gets mature, when you get your screen with the 8x10 feet picture on the wall in color and 3 dimensions, I'm afraid America will lose the use of its legs.
Yet here you are in Hollywood, working on a new television project that's going to earn you another tidy sum of money.
Some people try to make money by going to the moon. A more dangerous and odd enterprise than I'm doing.
Ben, we'll be looking forward to what you have to say and do on television. I thank you for taking this half hour to talk to us in Hollywood. And I wish you good luck when you join us in television.
Thank you, sir.
Good luck in hell, Mr.
Ben Hecht once wrote, "Were I able to put down a fraction of the thinking I have done, the truths I have held fleetingly by their tails, I would emerge as one of the geniuses of my time." By his own admission, Ben Hecht has fallen short of that mark, but he has emerged as one of the most disturbing and colorful characters of his time. And in an age of so much drab conformity, that's a kind of genius all by itself. In a moment,
You get kind of lonesome. That were close together, and then two more.
Then I threw them in. The bastard was born. You got this thing running?
Hmm?
You got this running?
Mm-hmm.
What for?
I want to hear about your life.
Well, that's a very poor life.
I don't think so. I remember the wonderful story you told about leaving Russia when I was here before.
You know, when my sisters got married, I had four sisters and three brothers. My father had a house and my stepfather had a house. We lived in our stepfather's house. In my father's house, it was rented for two families. For $50 a year.
Where was this? What part of
This is the Ukraine.
Ukraine. Were you the youngest?
The youngest. I'm only the sixth in the family.
The sixth?
I'm the sixth child in the family.
Oh.
And nobody cared for me anymore. Because, I tell you, when I was a small kid, I wanted to go to school, I wanted to learn, I'd given away half of my life. Nobody cared for me anymore. It was pitch dark when my mother went away. And she came home and it was dark.
She
was working. Well, she was selling, she was buying from the farmer and selling to the merchant.
Oh.
So.
What did she buy?
She was buying from the farmer the chickens, the eggs, the dried prunes, dried pears.
She'd bring them into town?
She'd sell them right there and downtown to the merchants.
Oh.
She carries plenty of bags on her back. And some of these farmers used to come into town. And they carry on a big stick, you know, we call it a romesla. I eat on each end a pail of plums. They call it over here the Italian plums.
Mm-hmm.
We used to buy it for 25 cents a bucket. And he carried it to town from the farm.
Oh.
The farmer carried it on his back. They had no horses, they had no... It was mostly the women that they used, you know, for horses.
And did your mother carry the stuff when she bought it?
She carried that stuff in her bags, yeah. Used to go and sell the merchant. But one thing that got me, I was in love with a fella. I wanted to marry him. My people didn't care to help me, and he was working for my brother-in-law, and when he came on holidays, he hired himself out for 6 months, and on holiday, on Easter, he came home. He had his pay, where he worked for 6 months. The people took away his money, and they was beating up on him, the way it was very near killed him. And he crawled out on his hands and knees, and he was laying behind the house. And then he, when he got better, he walked out of town to his brother-in-law and he went there over the holidays.
Who beat him?
His mother, his father, his sister, his brother-in-law. Because
what?
He wanted to marry me.
Oh, because he wanted to marry you?
But he got an older sister.
Oh.
And if the sister is older and the younger one gets married,
mm-hmm.
then she's going to be an old maid.
Oh. Mm-hmm. He couldn't marry till after she did.
Yeah.
Oh.
So when he came back to work after the holiday, he didn't say nothing, but it's gotta be my brother-in-law's, it's gotta be my brother-in-law's people that was telling me. because he wanted me to marry my brother-in-law's brother. So I got a spank about that too. You ever see anybody marrying somebody that you don't like?
The women were supposed to do that, arranged marriages, huh?
Yeah, but I don't even like the guy that I should go marry you. So I got a spank about that too. Well, I was saving my money and this fella, we had an uncle in New York.
Were you working?
Oh, gosh.
But where were
you? I worked when I was 8 years old.
What did you do?
Keep an eye for a lady that's got a grocery store that is busy, taking care of her children, cooking and baking and washing clothes and everything. Hmm. No, all of that, and my sisters was working too when they was young. They was all working. They was all working out. And then 6 years my mother lived alone. And then the neighbors start talking until she could be out. They don't see a woman being alone. She used to go away to work and leave all our children alone. We were 7.
And she had to feed you, I suppose.
She was a wonderful cook. She used to cook for rich people and bake for rich people. And used to give her some food to take home, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
She used to cook on weddings and parties. And they used to give her some stuff to take home. But lots of time there wasn't enough food in the house. So soon I must have been about 8 years old, I went to work. So they tapped into her to get married. He was a Hebrew teacher too. My father was a Hebrew teacher too. But he had 3 children. He didn't have enough to feed them. So she was like going out and buying 7.
You mean she married a man with 3 children and with her 7?
And with her 7. And 6 years later she had another child. Changed her life. She was 55 years old. She had a change her life baby.
Did it live?
Yeah, my sister, the Nazis murdered her. Along her husband and all of her children. It's my baby sister.
So that means she had 11 children then? With his children and her children?
Well, she had 8 children, at least 3.
Yeah.
You couldn't make no living.
Didn't these Hebrew scholars make anything at all?
Then he works all week, and on Thursday night, Thursday evening, he goes to the parents to collect the money. They didn't pay him enough money that he can buy bread for Saturday and a chicken and stuff and fish that we need for Saturday. They didn't pay him enough money. He's got to wait. And you know, I was a little kid, chunky little girl, you know, and these boys, he used to have a long table, and they sit all around, you know, and they, some boy was about 15 to 18 years old, that's higher class, you know, school, and then he asked the boy something, each week there's different cedra, different, you know, from the Bible. When he asked the boy something, they didn't know I answered that. They used to grab me and sit me down by the table with the boys. I just remember what they said the day before, you know, but I couldn't, you know, write nothing. Nobody wanted to have a teacher for me, so. Then when I was waking, I saw the teacher coming in another house. She'd go from house to house and they teach him the Bible, you know. Like ABC and stuff like that.
But they only teach the boys? Do they teach the women?
The women, they don't care to teach women. They don't. The parents didn't bother about teaching the women, the girls.
Mm-hmm.
It's the boy that has to go to school and learn. I mean, the Hebrew school, see. But the Russian school, there wasn't a good school for poor people. So So when I saw that teacher going out of that house, I ran out and I grabbed him by his tail, you know. And I said, "You come and teach me." He says, "What about your mom?" I said, "My mother's working." I said, "I ain't working, I'll pay you." So finally, Tata Dogo, then he come over there while I was working. She teach me Hebrew. So you know, for my other sisters, my mother tried to keep a teacher. None of them could read and write. And I was so anxious. I wanted to learn so bad, I'd given away half of my life. I paid the teacher to come to my house. And see, they got a little stick, you know, and this and that, you know. But that's Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to so that I learned about the rest of it by myself. And then I...
Can you read Yiddish if you read Hebrew, or do you have to learn Yiddish separately?
It's almost alike.
Is it?
And then to write. I went while I was there working, you know, I had a teacher on one month.
To learn to write.
To learn to write, you know, Yiddish letter. And then I learned the rest of it by myself. I used to go around, you know, and some kind of things, you know, my good area. Would you like to have an egg?
No.
And before the Jewish New Year, they had a holiday. Each person has to have a chicken. And they put them over your head, and you know, you say this. I read, you know, on the stuff. I was a little kid, you know, before I went to everywhere. I used to go around in the house and say that voices which you're supposed to say when you turn your head. Chicken on your head? I used to go around and say, Beina Yudam Yez Bechoshach Leitzal Mungus Asiyah. I used to go around and say it like that. I just went into that day. Nobody wanted to teach me, and I do it all by myself.
And how did you get books to read?
I didn't.
This man.
No, where am I? The usual apps on school, you know, it's in a private home. And it's boys usually go there, no girls.
Mm.
And lots of times there was accidents. They have a samovar, you know, standing in the corner to make tea, you know. You know what a samovar
mm-hmm.
is. Samovar is boiling and the kids will start playing around. They go through to that samovar and spill the hot water on them and one kid call it a death.
Mm.
My uncle, my mother's brother, was at that one of those schools, and my grandmother was living. I don't remember my grandmother. And he was sitting by the point of the table. See, he was sitting by the point of the table with his chair, and he was sitting at the point of the table. And he said something that he made a mistake, you know. The rabbi asked him something and he made a mistake. And he came over and he hit him in the back. And he fell to that point of the table and hit him the call of the spoon under his heart.
Mm.
And he was laying there. He couldn't move. Well, in the evening, he didn't come home. And they went to school and the rabbi says, "You don't know." They kept him there, hidden away, didn't call the doctor. And during the night, they took him over and put him by the bedroom window by my grandmother. They looked around, couldn't find him, they went to bed. And the other morning they come out in the parliament, he died. Mm. They didn't do nothing to the rabbi, because you're going to put him in jail, you can put him in jail, the rabbi, yeah. But you have to examine the body, see? Got to cut up the body to examine it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's against the Jewish religion. And then the rabbi go off. Didn't do nothing to him. Mm-hmm. Killed my aunt, killed him. Killed their kid.
Huh.
And they didn't do nothing for him. So.
Well, how old were you when you left him? Russia. How did you leave?
Well, you see, I tried to, you know, the fella. I was in love with it. I tried to really both go to America. So I sent letters to his uncle in New York. And his mother sent letters there that they shouldn't send him nothing. I didn't have enough money for me and him. And this money the folks took away and left me without a penny. So I thought I'll come here and then I'll send for him. And they told him, before you're 21, you got to report to the army. You're not supposed to marry. That's why sometimes, you know, they just marry, they used to marry one of the Jewish religion. Because it's against the law. They are so few. So they say they would report him, put him in jail, keep him in jail. Until he's got to, in fall, he's got to report to the army. So I don't know, they put him in the army and I asked my folks. Nobody sent me his address. Then the war broke out. And a letter I sent came right back, didn't get there. I had a few little miserable dollars over there on a bank. The six banks closed one morning when the war broke out in Europe, 1914. I had no money.
Your money was in the, lost in the bank?
I had a little money in the bank for any day. That was the dollars. I was working for $6 a week in the factory.
What kind of factory was that?
Millinery.
Oh.
I like to make that. So the... I tried there in Russia, you know, I went to live into the millinery store. I want to learn a trade. So she says I had to pay her $200 and wait for her for 2 years for nothing.
To learn?
To learn. To learn the trade. I thought it was a hot place. So when I came here, I went to work at millinery. So I was working in Feldman. I was working in Feldman's. Hmm? And this picture here is the girls that we work together. That's for mama. Maid in Dalkanta, they told their boy that I was an old maid.
Mm-hmm. So you get married about 16 or 17 then?
Yeah, about 18 or so, they got to get married, yeah. So...
And how old were you when your first child was born?
Our sister was born in 1915. February 15. February 15, 1916. And Heine was born August 20, 1917.
Mm-hmm. So then you had two children to support.
Two children to support, and none. And even around gambling, and you didn't stay very long in a place, you kept on room. See, before I married him, he was in New York, He came to marry another girl and find me like a fool. And the way he was talking, he was, he runs after the great novel. He was dressed in a uniform, you know, in conductor's uniform. He was thinking he was after the railroad, he was. So, you know, that guy was such a liar that he can take this one with this and put them together. And like a fool, I believed him.
Well, I bet he was a charming fellow. They usually
but
are.
You know, the wall was on, and I couldn't get no words from nobody. And there he was gone. What happened? They killed the whole family there. Hmm.
His family. Did you hear from your family after that, or were they still there? Did your mother didn't come here, did she?
Nobody came here. And my sister, the one who's in Buenos Aires, South America, she was well off. She had property, they had a business, and they was all right. And nobody cared for her to come to this country, and I didn't have the means to send for anybody. But I wanted Freaky, I wanted my sweetheart, you know, nobody wanted to help me. And there the war was on and you couldn't hear nothing from nobody. Get letters and you get it back to New York. Nobody...
You never heard from him again?
Never heard nothing. You see, sometimes parents can bury their children.
Can bury them?
Bury them. Can bury them.
Alive?
Yeah. We would have been the happiest couple in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And the other beat up on him, Livania killed him. Took him sent away from what he had. And said they had to report him to the government, they keep him in jail.
Just to keep him being
there? Keep him in jail, yeah. See, if they got a report of the army, in the army they are... My brother was 4 years and 8 months in the army. But he married before I got in the army, and that was only a Jewish wedding, but the government wasn't supposed to know. And they had a baby, and he went into the army, and she was working, keeping us for somebody, and keeping herself alive with the baby. And what the government paid the soldiers wasn't even enough to buy their cigarettes. He wanted a suit to come home, you know, and visiting. She had to buy him a suit.
You mean a Jewish wedding was not admitted by the government as
no.
a marriage? You'd
no.
have to have two
well,
weddings?
You had to have license from the government to marry.
To get married.
To get married. But the Jewish wedding is only in Christ.
Could a Jew get a license from the government?
Oh, yeah.
You had to pay for it, I suppose.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. So when I came here in 1910, I was living with Fanny, she's my sister-in-law's sister, and a fella that was on the steamer there, he was looking around for me. He took my address, I gave him the address, it was supposed to be my uncle. Mr. Wallach was living in our house in the old country for 10 years in detention, and he was in New York. And I had on his address, I gave him the address. And this guy was looking around for me all over.
You came all by yourself?
Yeah.
Did you come with anybody from your village or anything?
Nobody.
Just alone?
I came alone.
Weren't you scared? Coming to a strange country alone?
What for? What am I be scared for?
I'm scared here when I was born here sometimes.
No, I wasn't scared for nobody. I could always pay my way. I always worked and always made my living. Nobody ever bothered with me. Nobody ever helped me anything. And when they had to fix my house, my father's house, they took my money and used it.
Uh-huh.
And my sister had to get married, they took my money and they used it, my mother did.
Whatever you had was theirs?
Yes. But afterwards I decided, no more. Every penny, sometime I went to bed without supper, every penny I put in the post office, I saved my money. Then I had money for a car to go to America, but I didn't have enough for the tours.
Mm-hmm.
I had just enough of myself, and that fellow in New York never answered anything. So I promised him I'm going to try to bring him here. Sometimes I walked miles, you know, to look for a job there in New York. And then I got a job and I was working. I was trying to save a little money, and a little bit I brought and I put in the bank. When I came, I had a little bit of money I put in the bank, and the bankers changed the for American money, you know, the rubles for American money. And I came and I put in the bank, but I left. Some evening, the man came from the bank and he said that I gave him a false $5 bill. And he said that either I got to change it, I'll take it off of the book, or they'll send me back.
Oh.
Well, I didn't know. They told us to change the money to American dollars.
Somebody gave you.
So they gave me that money, and I took it down the bank and I put it in the bank. To give me another $5 bill. And this wasn't this one. That was 10 rubles. And I worked pretty hard for that in Europe. That was 10 rubles.
Did you lose money when you had it changed into American money, or did you gain money?
No, you see, 2 rubles was $1 that time.
Oh.
2 rubles. A ruble is a dollar.
Oh.
A ruble is a dollar there. But over here,
so you lost bad money.
For sure I lost.
Oh.
For sure. So.
Where did you get your first job?
Oh, I worked miles and miles before I get a job. I was working. Well, first I couldn't get a job, and I went to the employment office for doing some housework. And one Jewish lady, she called up, she wanted somebody to work for her, and she had a factory. And there was 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls, and her husband died. She had a dress factory, was making dresses. I went there to work, got $20 a month. I took care of all the 6 rooms, the 4 girls, they wore white blouses. I washed all the clothes, I ironed all the clothes, I bake, I cook, I scrub, I wash. And I sleep in the kitchen.
Hmm.
So after 1 month, I told them goodbye, and I left. I went out looking for a job, and I find the Artistic Millinery Company I was working for, the Artistic Millinery Company. That was on Broadway and Houston Street. And I worked there and I learned the trade. Then I went to work for Feldman, and that was in the same building. We needed girls there, I went to work for Feldman.
This was in Millinery.
Millinery, yeah. And one morning, we were sitting there and working. It was only piece work, you know. And
you got paid by the piece?
Piece work only, you know. I used to go out and look in the windows on Broadway, and I take a sample and I copy that. You know, when they keep a designer for these samples, they pay him quite good. But I used to make a sample, and sometimes they used to be busy on that, on those samples I made. The whole season they used to have good orders, but they paid me $1 for that hat. Otherwise it was about 25 cents a piece.
Hmm.
And you work so hard. So I worked there all the time until I got married. Well, until when the war broke out, I wasn't going to work. I could sit there. I could sit there and work and make about $6 a week.
Mm.
And the bank closed one morning, we got up and 6 banks closed their doors. I didn't have much, so I didn't really have enough to pay Mrs. for room and board.
You lost your money you brought over in the bank?
Yeah, I lost money when I brought from the old country, away on the bank. Jamalovsky went to Europe and the bank closed up. 6 banks and all in one morning.
Mm.
So then Kron came and tell me all these lies and talked into me, we should go and get Mayor's license. And I got the Mayor's license and I was going to give it back. I didn't want to buy it. That guy will talk and talk and talk. And he talked me into it, and we went and got Mayor's license. But first I sent letters to St. Paul. He was St. Paul working and I was in the Roma division. I sent letters to the train master, and he gave me a good reference about him. He was a good boy, and he had only 12 years rights on the division, on the Roma division. And I came here, I found he couldn't even stand on the extra board, no work, Any other big deal in the hotel? You had a big deal that he prayed for a girl there in the hotel? And by the way, when we left, he was so rich that he owned the great model. He didn't have the money to pay his hotel, but I had to give him money to pay to get his suitcase out.
You didn't know he was a gambler,
huh? I didn't know. And we went through, we came here to St. Paul and I find he was in debt. Mm-hmm. So when he did work a couple of days, I got to shoot his babies. Mm-hmm. Said nothing. So he rented a room on Canada Street in Grove. And, well, you see, when he's on the Vinma Division, he's running to Breckenridge, or running east, or running west, when he's in the Vinma Division.
Was he a conductor on that?
No, he was a brakeman.
Brakeman.
So finally, the rent wasn't paid. And I went out from the room to go someplace, I don't know what it was. And the landlady put a padlock on my door and wouldn't let me in. She said, the rent was paid. Mm. I just come, I'm a stranger here, I don't know anybody. So I had no place where to go. It was late in fall, it was cold. So I was sitting on the Union Depot. I had no money, nothing. I was sitting there on the Union Depot. I had no place where to get in and I didn't know anybody.
He was out on the run. Huh?
He was on the road and I didn't know where he was because he ran some time to Breckenridge, mm-hmm. sometimes some other place. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was in the extra, but he couldn't keep a regular run. So whenever they need him, they call him to work. So I don't know, I was sitting there 2 days and two nights on the depot. Hmm. Then finally came back.
How did he find you?
I don't remember how he found me either.
Did you have anything to eat either? He was
no idea what I could give. I didn't have nothing. I didn't have no money. I didn't have nothing. I was sitting 2 days and two nights in the Union Depot. Oh. I didn't know anybody to talk to. But there was a Jewish restaurant on Carrot Street and Grove Street. The chief used to go there off and on. They used to be there sometimes. So I came there one evening. This is after I rented another room. It was Grove Street. Grove Street, Canada, after I rented another room. Furnished room, you know, it was there. It was late at night and he didn't come, so I went to that restaurant to see if he was there. I said, is Mr. Cohen here? She said, no. I said, wait a minute. So, I wait a minute. She took me aside, the lady, you know, from the restaurant room. She said, he's in the back room. He's in the back room there. So I went in the back room and they sit in that playing, cast in that playing, and playing, and be the band. So I say, you want to come on? Pretty soon, and they play to be the band, play car. So I tell you, I just slammed the door and I went up, and then they come, you know, it was all alone. And he come home late at night, I don't know, it was 1 o'clock in the morning or so. And I told him, you've been playing cars, so why didn't you go back there? Go down there and play cars. So he always, you know, he used to talk so nice, you know, the dear wife, she says, you're the only anything in the world. And then when he goes out of the house, he does the same thing over again. Mm-hmm. And he used to borrow money here, and he used to borrow money there, and he used to borrow money some other place.
Well, a gambler always thinks he's going to win, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, always thinks now he's going to win for you.
Yeah. He'll do anything in the world for you. So that's what it did. So finally, then it happened, we moved out to Vilma. We rented a house there. But he didn't come into St. Paul.
Wilmer,
my son. Mm-hmm. We moved there. And Oh no, that was after the... Oh yeah. They removed that before sister was born. So, you know, I had no money. I didn't have nothing. So I came here and I stayed there with a woman and I asked her. And I wanted to find out if my time comes, if I'd be able to come to the hospital for the baby Paul. And I was expecting that in January. So I could talk then the way I talk now. Seems they couldn't understand me. They took me upstairs, took off my clothes and gave me a hospital robe. And they kept me there. So I told them, I didn't come to stay here. I just came to find out if after the time comes that I would be able to go to the hospital. I could get no answer from nobody. But they always call on me to take me into the delivery room and the students all around the table and pinching me and pinching me and pinching me. There must have been about 200 or 250 girls on that floor, unmarried girls. And they're sending out these stool pigeons, you know, to ask. And they find out I wasn't long enough in St. Paul. They claim you had to be a year in St. Paul before I can use it. Well, I didn't know about it. They could have told me that. Mm-hmm. I could have gone back. But no, these stool pigeons ran around and asked that woman and asked all over, you know. I didn't know anybody. I just knew that Mrs. Taylor, he roomed there before he came to New York. I just knew her. They went around all around. And they kept me there until they made me so sick that I was bleeding.
Oh.
He was pinching me and pinching me and pinching me and pinching me.
Then they were just using you in the...
For practicing purposes. They just used me. And there were so many other people there. And they called on me at that time. So they got me so sick I could hardly walk and I had cramps and I had pains. And then when Colin came in from East Fruit and he came there at the hospital, I told him I want to go home. So the doctor said she's liable to have the baby in the streetcar. She's going to have the baby in the streetcar. They scared me. Hmm. So I stayed there a while. And they kept on doing the same thing. And he had to go on the road again. And it was in January and the baby was born February the 15th. And all the trouble that made me, I was sick.
You stayed there all this time?
I stayed there all the time. And then when the baby was born, I was laying in the bed, like in a bathtub of water in my own blood. And they didn't do nothing for me. Hmm. And when I ring the bell, the nurse come up and pulled out. I couldn't even go to the bathroom. I couldn't even get a bedpan.
This was a general in St. Paul.
The city hospital. The city hospital.
Oh,
Dr. Inker, and the girls there, you know, they had their babies and then...